This is the Prepaid Podcast, brought to you by PrepaidReviews.com. Welcome to the Prepaid Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Polakowski. Well, there seems like no better topic to open with this month than the rumored merger talks between Virgin Mobile and SK Telecom, who is the parent company of Helio. Though SK has denied that any talks have taken place, Virgin kind of undercut that position and said, yes, they were in the early stages, nothing substantive yet, but it's something that they're definitely considering. Now, a lot of people have had a take on this, and the consensus I've seen the most is that Virgin stands to gain very little from this. Now, they're one of the largest prepaid companies, one of the largest MVNOs in the country. They've got over 4 million subscribers, and they seem to be going decently well despite some shaky financial reportings from the last couple quarters, basically since they went public. But they have a niche in the youth sector, and they serve this niche very well. They offer a number of low-priced phones, and they offer enough plans to the point where most people will be able to find one that will best suit their calling needs. Now, the problem with the merger with Helio is, while Helio does target the same demographic, they kind of go for the higher end. Their phones tend to be a little bit more expensive than the average Virgin Mobile phone, and because of all the data services that they offer, their monthly plans tend to be a bit more expensive than the average Virgin Mobile customer is going to spend in a month. Now, here's what I think Virgin would gain in a merger with Helio. First, they would gain access to a higher end of handsets, giving their customers more options. Now, they might not sell these handsets to their current customer base, but it gives people more of an incentive to switch to Virgin Mobile because of the higher end handsets. Why wouldn't those people just switch to Helio? Well, name recognition is definitely a part of it. Not a lot of people know about Helio despite their commercials, which I haven't seen one in a very long time. When you have a name brand like Virgin Mobile, it's almost marketing itself, branding as they say. Virgin also stands to gain entry into a postpaid contract style of offering. This is something that they actually explored up in Canada, combining their prepaid offering with contract offerings, giving their customers more of a choice in the matter. So Virgin does stand to benefit from this deal. However, they're not going to do it unless they know they can market the Helio services to the same degree that they've marketed their own services. It doesn't make sense for them to pull in a company that is just bleeding money if they don't have a solid plan moving forward, and if they're not sure that they can bring this service to a level of success it has not seen yet. So there are a number of details to work out before the two companies can even move to the next stages of a deal. And the nature of that deal still seems kind of up in the air. There was one rumor going around that SK Telecom would end up buying Virgin Mobile, and then they would bring Helio in a stock transaction. Not sure exactly how it's going to work. It'll be interesting if it does work, but it's not something I would count on at this point. It does add, though, to the conversation surrounding MVNOs, a conversation that really never seems to die. And that's because MVNOs are, well, dying themselves. We actually saw a latest one happen. Embark didn't exactly fold like a lot of the other MVNOs, but basically said, yeah, we're not performing to the level that we had thought, so we're going to stop sales once our inventory runs out, and once we deem it appropriate, we're going to switch people back over to Sprint, most likely. Now, the MVNO trend is something that, yeah, we're not going to stop talking about, but it definitely parallels certain events that have occurred in the telecommunications industry in the past. And to talk about this, we're going to go to Gene Retzke, editor of the Prepaid Press, and who has been in the industry for many, many years. How you doing, Gene?
Great, Joe, and how about you?
I'm doing very well this morning. Now, we've been talking a lot about MVNOs lately, especially because a lot of them have been falling off board and biting the dust, or as Sonopia was doing, going into hibernation. Now, apparently, this parallels other instances that have happened in the history of the telecommunications industry. And do you want to tell us about at least a couple of the examples that this kind of looks like?
Yeah, it is. It's a very familiar pattern, actually, to those of us who have been in the industry for a while. I came into the industry just after the Carter phone decision in 1968. And, you know, we saw a similar type of thing, you know, a little bit later on, like maybe mid to late 70s, early 80s with long distance. And I think long distance is probably about the best analogy here. Started out, it was a gold rush, companies large and small, startups, you know, as well as established companies diversified, you know, into long distance, you know, competition. And, you know, it was exciting and there was growth and so on and so forth. And then as time went on, some of the luster kind of fell off of the rose a little bit. And, you know, they realized that making profits wasn't, you know, just like shooting fish in a bucket, so to speak. And that they really actually had to go out and compete and, you know, have good marketing and have a differentiated offering and so on. And then we started to see consolidations, bankruptcies, you know, just all kinds of things like that. When I look at what's happened with the MVNOs in the last, say, 3 or 4 years, it's almost an identical pattern. But there is one difference.
And what's that?
It's kind of interesting. Well, the difference is that the long-distance, you know, scenario unfolded over a period of about 10 or 12 years. The previous one in equipment, you know, occurred over about a 12 to 15-year period of time. With the MVNOs, this has come and gone within a period of, what, 3 or 4 years?
Wow,
so
yeah.
It's been a highly accelerated time frame.
Well, I guess that might speak to the new technologies we're using for the communications. Now, what I wanted to ask you, actually, was whether with the long-distance companies, I know that AT&T had built out a nationwide long-distance structure, I guess, back in the 50s, was it? And
actually starting earlier than that, yeah.
Were these long-distance companies basically renting space from AT&T's national network?
It's almost an identical scenario to MVNOs where, you know, the cost of building that infrastructure yourself, building those networks, is really prohibitively expensive. Now, of course, in long distance, as with, you know, mobile, at the upper end, there were well-heeled people with a lot of finances and a lot of connections that could actually afford that. For example, Sprint, MCI, you know, some of these companies, even Quest later on, came in and actually did build their own facilities. In the MVNO world, of course, we saw the same thing. We saw, you know, it was mostly, you know, like 3 or 4 carriers, and then we saw some that actually started to build infrastructure. But it was primarily people who used the existing infrastructure under some kind of regulated regime where they were able to acquire those facilities at some discounted rate and then use, in essence, the carrier's own assets to go compete against them.
All right, and you talked about mergers happening in the long-distance company competitions, and we're seeing now rumors of MVNOs Helio and Virgin merging. Do you see, just out of historical trend, do you see this as being a positive move for them, or do you see it as being a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of move?
That's an interesting question because, you know, I guess you have to look at it from different perspectives. From the perspective of investors, the mergers and acquisitions generally work out pretty well. I mean, you know, if you take two companies that are struggling and they merge, you know, you often end up with one company that has enough stability, enough critical mass to continue on. So for the investors, it's okay. For employees, it doesn't end up as well because one of the attractive things about a merger or acquisition is, you know, cutting back on staff, cutting back on, you know, reducing expenses and so on. So they often end up, you know, not doing quite as well. But the real element here is what does it do to the consumer? And it's actually two conflicted trends that occur. One is that as these markets, you know, as these resellers come into the market, consumers often get a great price advantage. Sometimes they get some great service offerings because everybody's trying to differentiate, you know, and find that niche. But then as they start to merge and get back together again, the consumer, you know, gets back to a more oligopoly where there's just a few large players that are dominating the market, and so consumers end up with not as much choice, but some choice, and you know, they don't often end up with the big price advantage that they get early in the game. And I think we're seeing that now in the mobile arena as well. I mean, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, you know, consumers had just a wide range of choices with, you know, highly competitive pricing. And today, you know, a lot of that is compacted.
Now, I know Alex Beeson of the Beeson Group. has talked about market saturation being a big part of the competition and of MVNOs and of consumers having choices. And he says that once we get really close to a 100% saturation rate, that's when the competition will really start because everyone's going to be trying to pull from one another rather than an untapped pool. Is this a trend you've seen before too?
Yeah, it is in a way. Although, you know, I've talked to Alex myself. I mean, you know, Alex is a very bright guy and has a very good, you know, tilt on the market. I'm not sure if we're at the saturation point on mobile yet. You know, if you take a look at what's happening now, a lot of people are carrying more than one mobile set, and the mobile market is now eating heavily into the wireline market. You know, now over 50% of the people, almost two-thirds, as I recall, of people getting a telephone for the first time go wireless and not wireline. So, you know, that's opened up a whole new market for this. You know, and on the other side of it, you also see, you know, the data offerings that are coming out, the Edge and the EVDO and you know, the 3G networks and so on. And this is a new market. So I'm not sure how close to that saturation point we are. I think the demand for services, you know, and the applications for those services may grow faster than the ability to provide them, which means the saturation point will be, you know, probably years out in the future.
So he was saying about 3 years. You're saying that's a little optimistic that we're a bit further off from saturation in 3 years?
Yeah, I'm not sure when it occurs. I mean, because the thing that we can't anticipate is what kind of things are we going to be delivering wirelessly in the future? For example, cable TV. I mean, I've seen where there's some packetized, you know, streaming cable TV that may be offered wirelessly with technologies that are not fully refined yet. So if that happens, then all of a sudden we're going to see huge competition with the cable companies. So that'll open up a whole new market. So I'm not sure really where the saturation point is going to come in. Now, if you look at straight voice services, even there, I'm not quite certain what's going to happen because you know, I've seen a lot of people. I'm here in actually Beverly Hills this week, and I see people carrying three, four, five cellular phones on their belt. So I don't know where the saturation point's going to come.
Well, it's also, I guess, going to be as you were, this kind of goes along with what you were saying before, as we converge voice and data services. And I know this is a big topic at CTIA, where they were talking about getting voice off the current voice radio frequency and getting it onto the data so everything's running on the same frequency and can run more efficiently. So I guess, you know, where's the saturation point then when you have some people using the hybrid voice data networks and some people just running on the data networks?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, let me just give you one perspective on that. I remember in 1975, not to, you know, go back and tell old war stories, I went to a conference in Atlanta where they talked about the convergence of voice and data. And that was, you know, before cellular, before, I mean, wireless at that time was IMTS. So, I mean, you know, there was really only wireline that we were talking about. And they were talking about, you know, complete convergence of voice and data within 10 years. That was 1975. So by that estimate, it should have happened by 1985. It really has not completely happened today, but it's taken a lot longer. And I'm not sure what the reason for that is, but I would guess in the wireless arena, I don't think we'll ever see complete convergence. But, you know, the question is to what extent will it be converged? What is interesting about that, though, is when 3G comes in, what is going to be the impact on the existing wireline or wireless carriers, the facilities-based wireless carriers? What is going to be the impact on their pricing structures? Because now you'll be able to use, in essence, VoIP, you know, or some data service like that in order to compete, you know, with the voice services on the cellular phones. And I think it'll put a lot of downward pressure on prices when that happens.
And that's what we're always looking for, and that's why I think we've possibly seen the slowing of the estimates that you heard back in 1975, where we're talking, they said, you know, it's going to be converged, it's going to be converged. Well, the convergence leads to a short-term loss in profits until they can adapt to the business model. So it's understandable why some companies would hold back on that until they can get a grip on exactly how they're going to handle it.
And that's the nice thing about competition. Sometimes they don't have the option to hold back because if they don't do it, somebody else will. So
That's, I think, we're
the
seeing
one
a
thing I
lot
can
of in the
tell you is
wireless
this.
industry.
Sorry?
I think we're seeing a lot of that in the wireless industry, where people
Oh,
are
I
starting
agree.
to
I
take
and
risks and jumps and getting things out there and making sure other people get it out there too.
Oh yeah, and that's the exciting part about this. I mean, when all this started back in the early 70s, you know, in the telephone business, it was an exciting run for 30 years. I mean, really exciting, the things that happened, the technologies, you know, just all the things that occurred. And I think now, today, in the wireless world, I feel that same energy. I see that same thing getting ready to happen. So, you know, we're getting ready to enter the cycle again. The question is, how different will it be? We don't know.
Well, I'm sure that's something we'll have time to discuss in the future, plenty of times. Thanks, Gene, for coming on.
Okay, Joe, I really appreciate it. It was interesting talking to you.
Right, and once again, we are here with Gene Retzke, the editor of Prepaid Press. An issue that came up this month that I took a particular interest in was proposed legislation to require an ID presentation for purchasing a prepaid phone. Now, this isn't going to be popular with the prepaid crowd, it's pretty clear. The thing with prepaid that we all love is no contracts, no credit checks, which has equated to no hassle. You can walk into a Walmart, a Target, really any retail outlet, pick a phone pack off a shelf, and for, you know, $30, $40, have not only a phone, but some startup minutes. Of course, because they're so easy to obtain, they've been the objects of abuse in some instances. One of the bigger instances is the use by drug dealers of prepaid phones because they're basically untraceable. You can walk into a Walmart, buy a prepaid phone, use it, use it, use it, and if someone's ever onto you, you toss it in the garbage, you go out, you buy another one. And there's no way to trace how many you're buying because you're buying them at different times and presumably different carriers and purchasing them from different stores. The other form of abuse has come in trafficking. And what this entails is people going to stores, buying phones en masse, and then unlocking the phones or altering them some way and selling them as new. Now, the problem with this is, with these packs that we're talking about, carriers subsidize them. They give the phone at a discount, hoping that the minutes that you buy in the future for that phone will cover the cost and obviously then some. TracFone has sued a number of these operations, and this week we actually saw the first federal conviction of a man who was performing these trafficking operations. So we're going to sit down and talk with a lawyer for TracFone to discuss the ramifications of this decision. I'm here now with Jim Baldinger, attorney for TracFone. How you doing, Jim?
Good. How are you, Joe?
Good. Now, what we're here to talk about is a recent case where TracFone got a guilty plea, is it, in a phone trafficking case?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't TracFone who got the guilty plea. It was the government. It was the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Texas.
And what was TracFone's role in the case then? Were this the victims of the trafficking, or?
TracFone is one of the victims. The defendant was a guy named Mohammed Mubashir. And he had been sued by two different wireless providers, by Virgin Mobile and also by TracFone. I handled the TracFone case. And in both cases, he agreed to the entry of a permanent injunction against him by the court. The criminal case that he pleaded guilty to on Friday was a claim by the U.S. attorney, by the federal government, that he had violated the Virgin injunction, and they sought to have him held in criminal contempt of court, and he's agreed that that's appropriate now and pled guilty.
So, is it fair to say that if TracFone and Virgin hadn't brought their cases against them in the first place, that the federal attorney probably wouldn't have as much of a case against them?
Yeah, it wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been the underlying case. That was the way this that was the legal mechanism that was used to get the conviction.
Now, so this doesn't seem like a straightforward, this is the conviction kind of case. Obviously, there was more to it. Is this going to set any kind of legal precedent moving forward for how we're able to deal with traffickers?
Well, I hope it will, and I hope that it sends the right message to the people who are out there doing this. You know, I think that people who are involved in this business, and I assume your listeners are familiar with how this whole process works, they have what we contend in the lawsuits that we filed, and we filed, I think, close to 50 of them around the country. We contend that these people have built a business essentially structured around stealing the subsidies that TracFone and other wireless providers use to make their phones affordable to the public. And so we hope that the message that comes out of the Mubashir conviction is that this isn't going to be tolerated anymore. That if you're out there doing this, you're likely to get sued, and you could end up going to jail, as we expect Mubashir will.
Do you think that federal attorneys in the future will be able to press legal charges without the individual or company being sued by a provider?
We assert in the lawsuits that we file a number of claims that have both civil and criminal liability, meaning if you violate this law, you could either be sued civilly or the government could come after you criminally, or both. And so we think that there's plenty of opportunity for the government to go after these people criminally as well, although, you know, we're not the government. I represent cell phone companies, and so we don't have the ability to press criminal charges, but we hope that law enforcement authorities will, and we know that they're taking this seriously, and I think the Mubashir conviction is an example of that.
Now, you said you had a bunch of lawsuits pending around the country for similar cases.
Yeah.
Verizon kind of did this with rogue telemarketing companies that were sending mass text messages out to the subscribers. Do you think that TracFone is using the similar strategy of just being overly aggressive against traffickers in order to deter them?
No, I don't think we're being overly aggressive at all.
Well, I shouldn't say overly aggressive. I just mean very aggressive to the point where you're sending a message that you do this and we're going to file suit against you.
Well, look, I mean, these people are hurting TracFone's business, but they're also hurting consumers, and they're hurting the very people that TracFone is trying to get wireless service to, because, you know, TracFone and the other wireless providers can only continue losing millions of dollars as a result of this practice for so long. And after a while, they're not going to be able to continue doing this anymore if we don't find a way to shut it down. So, you know, it's unfortunate that there are so many people out there doing this and that it's so widespread. And TracFone absolutely wants to send the message, as I know other wireless providers do as well, that this conduct's not going to be tolerated, and they're going to do whatever they can to stop it, you know, whether that means filing lawsuits, whether it means assisting the government in any way we can when they bring these prosecutions. So I hope it sends a really strong message.
Now, as a quick note on the consumer end, how it's hurting the consumer, I've heard that when they're reselling these phones, they're selling them branded as new. Did that have any standing in the case, or is that just an incidental fact?
No, it's not incidental at all. In fact, I think that's a key part to the cases that we bring. We have a lawsuit pending right now, one of many, but one that's pending in Miami, where we've sued a company that resold track phones, still branded as track phones, but they had been hacked and what's called reflashed, meaning the operating system was reinstalled and the TracFone proprietary software had been wiped out and the phones had been unlocked. They were resold on websites for a major online retailer in the U.S. So what you have is a consumer buying a product and still had the TracFone label on it. So you have consumers buy a product, it says TracFone on it, but it cannot and actually can never again work as a TracFone because the software that's required to use it as a TracFone has been completely wiped out. We also get reports that frequently those phones where they have either an old version of the operating software put in them, something that, you know, maybe some shareware that's floating around out on the web, that oftentimes they don't function as they should. Certain functionality doesn't work, or the reception's not as good, or, you know, all the things that you would expect from a brand new phone, and particularly when it's represented to you as a consumer to be a brand new phone, you'd expect things to work properly, and they don't because the phones have been hacked or they've been tampered with. So that's also, I think, a tremendous problem for consumers, and I think it's another reason that law enforcement and regulatory authorities should care about this and should get involved, and I think it's a reason the public should really care about it.
And now, moving back to the storefront where the original purchases are taking place, there's been legislation proposed in a couple states that will require people to present an ID to purchase a prepaid phone. Is this something that TracFone is getting behind?
Well, I'm not representing TracFone on those issues. I know that they do have legislative assistants who work with them on that stuff. I mean, I can tell you that I think in principle, the idea of having people present IDs sounds like a great thing. What concerns me about it personally is that I don't think it's workable. If you can imagine, you're standing in line at the cashier at Walmart, and as they're scanning through all of your purchases, they say, "Okay, well, now I need you to take out your driver's license because you just bought this phone, and I need you to fill out all this information." And in the meantime, you got 25 people stacked up in line behind you. I just think practically the because of the type of sale that is used for getting this product in the hands of consumers, I don't think that the whole ID thing really is a workable concept.
And I also think, to add to that, it goes back to, and not to bring politics into it, but the Indiana voter ID laws, where you're going to have some people who just don't have that kind of access, who still need cell phone service. So you're really cutting off a portion of your user base by doing that as well.
Well, I think that's a great point. And, what prepaid providers, one of the markets that they help to serve, and TracFone in particular, is to get phones in the hands of people who otherwise either couldn't afford them or don't have sufficient credit to be able to get a postpaid service. And I think you're exactly right. There's probably a large segment of that population that might not be able to comply with an ID requirement, and then they'd be prevented from getting wireless service, which would be a shame.
Now, before we wrap up here, I was wondering if this was a publicly available number or something that was brought up in the case, as far as how much revenue has been lost in terms of these trafficking incidents.
You're talking about company-wide or industry-wide?
Industry-wide would be an even better number if you have it.
I really don't. I've seen from my perspective, I think I've seen a little slice of this industry. I can tell you that I believe it is rampant. I've seen situations all over the country where the shelves in Walmarts and Targets and other big box retailers are simply bare of prepaid phones because traffickers have bought them all up, and so legitimate consumers don't have access to them. But I don't have any hard numbers that I can give you. I just don't have access to that information.
Though you are saying, though, that the companies are getting cut off on two fronts, not only on losing the subsidy, but losing potential customers who come into a Walmart and would have bought something and walk out empty-handed instead.
Absolutely, absolutely, losing potential customers. And then also, when somebody goes and buys a phone that's been hacked and it still has the provider's logo on it, they're losing goodwill and their reputation's getting hurt. When they buy a phone that doesn't work well and it still says TracFone on it, that hurts TracFone. So all of those things are the basis for our lawsuits and the different claims that we assert.
Well, we'll definitely be keeping up with coverage of these kinds of suits in the future, as they seem pretty important to the prepaid industry. Thanks for talking to us, Jim.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joe.
Once again, we've been here with Jim Baldinger, attorney for TracFone. That about wraps up this month's edition of the Prepaid Podcast. Join us at the same time next month when we run down issues in the prepaid industry. Take care.